Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to episode 680 with my guest, Kaylee Powers. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, which is a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past trauma, sexual dysfunction, and everyday compulsive negative thinking. And this show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I am not a therapist. Just came back from my favorite Thursday night support group meeting, and oh my God, the guy that spoke there was so fucking good, and I'm hoping to get him to come on the podcast. He gave me his number, so I think we're going to make that happen, but oh, can't wait. Can't wait for you guys to hear him. We are at, God, I forgot what it is, 890 Patreon donors, and we've kind of plateaued, and we really, really need some more support. And I'm sure those of you who have already stepped up and donated are like, oh my God, I've already donated. Do I have to keep hearing this fucking message? But I'm a big proponent, and if you need help, ask for it. And so we need help. Ads are great, but they do not pay the bills. We depend on sponsors and or donors. And we have posted some new stuff on Patreon, some Gracie videos, some videos of me doing a little bit of woodworking in the shop. And I know there was something. Oh, I know what it was. Well, I'll address it. Somebody asked a question in a survey, and I'll just address it when we get to that. But Gracie, I don't know if you guys can hear her in the back, but sometimes, you know how dogs have the zoomies where like they get super excited and they run around? She doesn't really do that, but she does it on the bed on her back. She gets really excited, and I love it. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, and this is filled out by a trans woman who calls herself Liz. And about her depression, she writes, "It feels like knowing and believing that the world is full of beautiful and vibrant colors, but still seeing it in black and white." About having fibromyalgia, and another thing that I am sure I'm going to butcher, ankylosing spondylitis. And I'm not laughing at your illness, at just how, hang up, crazy. Like to pride myself on being able to pronounce big words, and I'm at a loss. Anyways, she writes, "It feels like my body trying to tell me that I am not supposed to exist." That, wow. I'm sorry that you are dealing with that, and that you listen to a podcast where the host doesn't even take the fucking time or have the decency to learn how to pronounce it before reading it on air. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Curious Kazoo. And she writes, "Is that your music at the end of episode 674 with Leah Rudick? I really loved it as closing music, perfect for some quiet reflection before emerging from the podcast back into the real world." Yes, that is my music, and that's one that's called Floating Pig, which is a Pink Floyd reference, her big influence. on me. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Hackles Up, ? And about his depression, he writes, I'm a great cook, limited to cooking microwave dinners. About having OCD, if my right foot doesn't hit the concrete outside my door before the left one, terrible things will happen. Thank you for that. Yeah. Oh, that is one of the worst parts of depression, is being a foodie and just not having the energy or the vitality to sit down and cook. It's like your brain is just a field of fog. This is also from the Struggle in a Sentence, and I'm going to withhold this person's name. I don't know if they fully knew. There's some of the things that they share here because they're a public figure that I believe that if I were to say their name, they might be publicly identifiable, and there's some really personal stuff that she shares, and she's a teenager, about her sex addiction. She says, sometimes I masturbate so many times a day, I start falling asleep during it. I just want to feel good. About being a sex crime victim, my parents don't let me use the word victim, just survivor. I don't feel like I survived. About experiencing racial or cultural bias, even I don't believe it when I say I'd be just as successful if I weren't Japanese and making content appealing to Japanophiles. Snapshot from her life. My video's been live for 4 hours. I sneak a peek at my analytics on my phone under my desk, glancing through the comments. The upvote ratio is astronomical. The comments are all positive, not a single piece of hate. My stomach hurts like I've been kicked anyway. Anxiety telling me there's no way these people can all mean it. I haven't eaten in 2 days. Some part of me whispers, how many of the people watching you have an Asian kink, just like the man who raped you? A YouTuber I've watched and admired for 3 years leaves a glowing comment. I should be happy. I look at my unfinished homework and wish my ADHD would let me be good at things everyone else cares about. Would my YouTube idol like my content if she knew I like girls? And I have to take illegal benzos for my panic attacks? Will anyone ever like the real me? Thank you for sharing that. You sound like you're in a lot of pain. There's a documentary that I have not watched yet, but it's about the suicidal ideation and depression that so many influencers have. And I would imagine that there's a lot of people who are like, when the fuck do I want to watch those, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because so many people, I think, see somebody who's got a million followers on TikTok and think, you know, you just think, oh, they've got every problem solved. They've got it made. But I don't know, when I was at my most successful financially and in terms of visibility, doing television. Do we all remember what a television was? I was at my most suicidal. This is an email that I got from a guy named Rob, and he writes, the choreography of your distinctive encounter is unfolding, with our team intricately piecing together a mosaic of excellence that promises to be uniquely yours. And then there's a transaction detail number and a product key number. And the choreography of your distinctive encounter is unfolding. A lot of people thought that when I double majored in encounter and dance, that I was wasting my time. But I could tell you, I do not look at that double major as a waste of time. I've had my ballets reviewed by some of the most influential periodicals in the encounter dance world. In fact, one reviewer said that he believes that my ballet was the most realistic portrayal of a waiter being asked for ketchup by a swan that he had ever seen. I want to say hi to the team over there, because I do take pride in Mosaic excellences. Have I mined this? Is there any ore left at the bottom of this? I've got about 9 other things written down that I wanted to riff on that. And honestly, I feel like the entire thing was a waste of time. But wow, how did that get generated? That had to have been a drunk AI that generated that, right? This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by Zach. And about his anxiety, he writes, I am chum in the water trying to get past the sharks. About his anorexia, nothing tastes as good as being hollowed out inside feels. I know it'll kill me, but it's too good to quit. About his love addiction, I will set myself on fire to keep people warm and then wonder why I'm burned out. About being a sex crime victim, she devoured me whole and no one even noticed. And about his self-harm, I'm only real when I'm bleeding. Oh, that is so heavy. Snapshot from his life. It's 5 a.m. I haven't eaten in 3 days. I can remember my babysitter telling me as she molested me that I was cute, that she liked how chubby I was. The scale today said I'm at my lowest weight in my life. I'm aware I need to eat in order to do what I need to do at work. I'm afraid to do it. I'm awake because I had a nightmare about one of the YouTubers I watch molesting kids. That happens a lot when I try to watch women who are YouTubers. I want to hurt myself, but I don't think I can spare the energy and still get through the day unless I eat, but I don't think I can eat without feeling guilty unless I hurt myself. Wow, that is a vicious treadmill. Fuck. Sending you some love, Zach. You know, I talk often on the podcast, or I should say, I'll point out frequently how there are kind of similarities between surveys that just happen to have been chronologically taken together. And I pulled a couple of the ones that I was going to read on this week's episode because they were so fucking dark. And I'm going to save them for another darkest surveys ever. Episode. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by Dorth Vader, and about her depression. She writes, major depressive disorder. My feet weigh more than my entire body. I am so heavy, I feel like I should be laying on the ground. About her ADD, getting locked outside in minus 10 with no jacket and wearing flip-flops. About her OCD, there is something wrong with my face and my hair, but I don't know what. About her codependency, if I take care of you, I can ignore my meth addiction. Snapshot from her life. I was trying to use the bathroom and I suddenly could not stand. I was falling all over the room with no pants on. Next thing I see is 5 EMTs performing CPR on me. I overdosed again, but for some reason, I cannot fucking die. Any comments to make the podcast better? I really enjoy your responses to the scam emails. I've been listening to the show since you were on That's Deep Bro with Christina P. I just bought a t-shirt. Thank you. Can you make stickers of the logo for the shop, the Threadless shop? And I would love a sticker for my computer. Done, m'lady. 'Tis your wish. Yes, I'm glad you asked for that. So I also checked the box for mugs, phone cases, notebooks, mouse pads, t-shirts, and sweatshirts. And hopefully soon I will also have wigs, tampons, and coffins. This is an interesting... You know what, I'm gonna save this one for after the interview. I want to get to the interview with Kaylee. We are going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And then finally, this is from the Love Survey filled out by Danish Delight. And they write, I love cold butter melting on freshly baked bread. That's a good one. Although I don't know if I'm ever fired up about cold butter. I usually think, why the fuck didn't they let this get to room temperature? Don't they know the effort I'm having to go through? I love the smell of autumn. I love summer rain and the smell of the warm asphalt, just getting wet by the rain. I love when my dog is so excited to go to the park and sets off at such a speed that his ears flap way behind him and his eyes almost fall out of his little head. I love when the wind rustles in the big treetops in our garden. I like that one. I love new crispy sheets dried outside on the clothesline, and you can still smell a little bit of wind and outside when you go to bed. I like that phrase, a little bit of wind and outside. I love to sniff my baby's little scalp and neck. If I could get that in a bottle. I love when my youngest daughter wakes up at the same time every night, and I can hear her tiny steps running through the hallway, and she snuggles up to me, rubbing her tiny cold feet against my warm skin, and she pats me on the cheek and says, "Nighty night, mommy."
That feeling of being trapped in your own life with no way out.
All my alters have different handwriting, different affects.
I'm somebody in prison.
My mom taught me about rape.
And I'm nobody on the streets.
Before she taught me about love.
Nobody will ever love me enough.
There's two lies.
A kind pimp.
Yes.
The secret, shameful life at home.
Happiness isn't the goal.
That you always just don't talk about. And then there's the front.
The goal is meaning.
It's hard to go into the dark places.
I should have leaned into that feeling and gotten curious about it.
Recognize when your fears are driving your behaviors.
What you resist gets louder.
And run toward them.
She said, "You first." And I said, "I might be gay. I was with a girl." And I said, "And what do you have to tell me?" She said, "I'm moving to Florida and this is my last session."
I'm here with Kaylee Powers, who is your social worker.
Substance abuse counselor. Who's done social work.
Oh, okay. Okay. Because one of the things when we talked via email, as you had mentioned early in your mental health profession, you worked on Skid Row as a social worker.
Yes.
And that's kind of where you learned a lot of the...
Yes, I was the only substance abuse crisis counselor at the center I was working at. So I was working with all social workers.
Was this Dee Dee Hirsch or a different one?
This was the Downtown Women's Center.
Okay. Which you said is a great facility.
Very, very amazing organization. They do housing. They do meals. They do case management. Pretty much they're a place, they're a safe haven for the women on Skid Row.
And we're talking about downtown Los Angeles for
yes,
the listeners.
Yes, next to LAMP. It's on Los Angeles Street.
What's LAMP?
LAMP is one of the biggest shelters. It was the one that was featured in that movie with Robert Downey Jr. It's a very famous shelter. So it's a center, and they can go there. They can have counseling, groups. So I was doing counseling. I was doing groups. And they can have meals, And it's just a safe place for them to be for 8 hours a day before they have to get their beds and go back to the shelter.
I got you. So talk about what, paint a picture, if you would, and especially if you can think of any vignettes that kind of represent the situation on Skid Row, and especially anything that you can think of that goes beyond the stereotype that the person who has never been to Skid Row has in their mind.
One of the things that I was surprised by is they do have substance abuse treatment centers down there. However, most of the homeless clients have never been to treatment, even though they have beds open, because they don't even know that that's available. They don't even know what that is. They have mental health issues, and they use drugs, self-medicating to cope, and they're not even aware that they could go into a treatment center for 60, 90 days, detox, get some help. So what I was trying to do was build that bridge between the social workers and the treatment centers, trying to link the two organizations. So I was walking up and down in Skid Row, banging on doors, asking, do you have beds? What could I do to get one of my clients in here? And I was also training a lot of the social workers addiction.
And for the people that don't know, when they mean a bed, what they mean is an opening in a facility for people to get treatment. It's more than just a place to sleep at night. It's a place to get counseling, perhaps get on medication if needed, because often people are dual diagnosed, which means there might be an underlying depression or trauma in addition to an addiction.
Pretty much everyone on Skid Row is dual diagnosed, but they've never been diagnosed with any of it. They can't. Even though they've been seen by many psychiatrists or social workers, they just can't get out of that loop. They can't get out of that cycle. But what I did find is most of them have never learned about the addiction part of their dual diagnosis or had any treatment for it. Even the support groups are not really there the way we have access to them in other places.
Do you feel like it's different now that there's more awareness that there's treatment options for people? And we're talking about free treatment options, correct?
Yes. Usually through Medi-Cal or whatever insurance they have. I don't know if it would be different because the housing crisis has gotten worse since I started in the field.
And that's an understatement.
Yes.
It's exploded here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
So exploded.
The reason that treatment for substance abuse is not focused on is because in social work, the model is treat the most urgent need first. So if they don't have shoes, you go to the closet and you get them shoes. If they don't have a place to sleep, you try to find them a shelter. If they haven't eaten in 3 days, you get them a meal. Going to a treatment center for an addiction is almost a luxury they've never had access to. That's not considered an urgent need. Like, where am I going to sleep tonight? Or, you know, can you give me tokens for the bus? It's that level of survival. So I was trying to link the two. I don't know how far I got. I was there 10 months. It was an internship.
Give me some vignettes of your time on Skid Row.
I remember this one day I was upstairs running a group and it was about to complete. And I got a call from one of the girls downstairs. And these are all social workers. They have maybe one class in addiction, which is very strange in itself. They said, there's somebody down here. Can you come talk to her? She seems like she might be an alcoholic and she might be under the influence. So I go down there, Native American. I start asking her questions. She's all beat up from her shoulder down, bruised, had a blackout, doesn't remember where she was, found herself at the center. And I asked her, I said, are you Native American? Because she was working with a Native American organization that treats alcoholism. And she said, yes. And I said, well, honey, you can't drink. And she's like, I know, I'm allergic to it. And so I sat with her for an hour or so, and I tried to...
Hold that thought for a second. You sat with her for an hour or so. Why was it important to ask her if she was Native American?
Because she was working with that organization.
That's where
her stuff was, possibly.
I see.
Right. And they seem to have a violent allergic chemical reaction to alcohol that I haven't seen in other populations. And so I always like to ask sometimes what culture someone's from, because it also plays into their experiences, what they understand about addiction, what they don't understand. So I sat with her for about an hour. I called to get her stuff. We found her a place to sleep for the night. We gave her water. There's no, you know, medication or anything available at the center. But at least I understood what she was going through. I understood the blackout. I understood the reaction. So that's one story that I can recall, but it's been a long time. I've had about 2,000 other vignettes since then. That was in 2010.
Share some with me. And Kaylee is a what's called a KDAC, which is Certified Addiction Drug Counselor?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Through the state of California.
Yes.
That's the license. However, because I was at D.D. Hirsch for 5 years, I was trained in mental health. Again, I was the only substance abuse counselor in 2 residential houses. So I was working with mental health clinicians, really amazing ones. They were teaching me about psych evaluation, symptoms, medication, stabilization. I was teaching them about detox, withdrawal, long-term recovery, support groups. So D.D. Hirsch was one of the pioneers of dual diagnosis.
They're great. They're a great organization here in L.A., yeah.
I learned so much there.
So give me some vignettes.
Well, let me think. There's so many. One time, I had a client that was a younger client. She was suffering from crack addiction. She was maybe 2 weeks clean. This was a residential house, so we had 10 clients, 3 or 4 staff. They would stay with us for 30 days. We would have them cook. They cooked their own meals.
Was this also a detox facility?
We did detox there, but we weren't set up like that.
Gotcha.
But it would happen. So they would be there for 28 days. You do outings, groups. They get a psychiatric evaluation. They're seen by the psychiatrist. They get therapy. And then they get me, which does the drug counseling. So she started to bang her head against the wall violently because she had had an episode with her girlfriend on the phone. And now it's me and another girl, and it's late at night. And the last thing you ever want to do is call the police. We're trained to de-escalate, do everything you can to get them calm so they can make it through the night. However, she kept banging her head against the wall, and now she's going to harm herself. So there is such a thing called the PET team, psychiatric emergency team, but they don't come for about 4 hours.
Yeah.
So by then, the person could have jumped off the roof. So we had to call the police. So the police come, and this cop starts giving me a lecture about how it's not safe for me and this other girl to be working in this house, and we shouldn't have called him, and you need to tell your boss. And the client starts to see me stand up to this client, you know, because I don't speak to the clients ever in any type of assertive tone, but he was giving me grief, and I'm just trying to keep my client safe.
Right.
And so the client, she kind of comes out of her episode and is looking over at me, and he's like, you need to tell your boss that this isn't safe. And I said, don't you think we've communicated that? I said, do you have a boss? And we're going back and forth. I said, look, are you going to help my client or not? Like, what's the bottom line here? He eventually did end up helping her, calming her down. But, you know, the police are not really trained in mental health.
They're not. They're not. It's changing a little bit in some places, but it's woefully lagging.
They're just thrown into it.
Yeah. And you know, they have enough things to do that it seems like slapping that onto their training and expecting them to have the expertise of a PET team is perhaps unrealistic. I don't know.
Very unrealistic. Yeah. One time I had a cop come in with a rifle. I said, ma'am, I have clients here with mental health issues that I'm trying to stabilize. You come in here with the gun, you're going to trigger them, and that's going to take me all night to get everybody settled down. Well, I'm here for the safety of me and everyone involved. What she was called about was a girl had taken a plastic coat hanger and was just trying to cut herself on her wrists. It wasn't anything that needed a rifle.
So a pistol, Kaylee. A large pistol, like from the Old West.
So these are the kind of situations that you're faced with.
That's so darkly comedic. That's so fucked up.
Yeah, one time in Inglewood, we called the police. And like I said, it's always the last resort. But in 5 years, there's a couple incidents where you had to. Six cops showed up in my Inglewood residential. And I don't know what was going on that night, but they looked like models. They were like these gorgeous policemen. And I said, did we need six of you? Because they are able to put somebody on a hold. That's their main thing. They can put somebody on a 5150 if needed. Mm-hmm. You know, we wish the PET team could respond instead of the police having to do it, but we couldn't do it.
Right.
So we needed the police to do that for us.
Did their pants come off with Velcro? Because they might not have been real police.
It was bizarre. I didn't know what was going on that night. I was just looking at them like, why do you guys look like you're about to do a dance routine or something? You know, this is very strange. But, you know, you're just dealing with all kinds of characters on all kinds of levels. Everyone comes from different backgrounds. You just never know what you're walking into on a daily.
And you're also dealing with people coming in, the police, who themselves have PTSD, most of them or a lot of them.
Right. Right. And you have to be very clear to the clients. They are here to 5150 you. And most of them know what that is, because obviously, with a lot of my African-American clients, just the sight of the police is going to send them into an episode. So you're also, you need to have them do the hold possibly, but then you also need to keep the other ones from feeling unsafe.
And so what do you do? How do you de-escalate, calm
them? Well, when you
them?
Have a rapport with a client, and that takes a skill to build, when you can make them feel safe, they will trust you. They will believe that you're not going to throw them in the back of a cop car. You know, I might be the only white girl they've ever met that they trusted. And I have to work for that. But once you get that trust, they're loyal. So they'll believe you. If you tell them, I'm not going to harm you, this is what's going to happen, they believe you.
And how do you build that trust?
You give them a lot of space. I remember one lady, she did not trust me, and she's, I'm leaving. I said, okay. So we got her stuff, put it by the door. She looked at me. Okay, I'll stay for another hour. Okay. Took her stuff, put it back in the closet. 2 hours later, comes up again, looks me straight in the eye. I'm leaving. Okay. Got the stuff again. We did this about 5-6 times. By the sixth time, you're not going to fight with me? You're not going to try to talk me out of it? I said, ma'am, I'm here to be of service. This is for your own mental health. If you don't want to be here, you know, that is your right. You're here voluntarily. And that was it. Then she trusted me.
Do you remember what the rest of her stay was like?
We did some good counseling.
Are you free to talk about that? I know you need to respect the anonymity. Is there anything you can share that's general enough?
I think she started to open up to me about her domestic violence history, started to tell me what she had been through. The saddest part of this whole process is you work so hard to help them get 28 days clean, stabilized on their medication. And then guess what happens? When they're ready to discharge, a lot of them don't have anywhere to go. So what do you think happens when they get back on the street? They're not able to stay clean. Another thing I was finding is if I were to take them to a sober living, they'd be using at the sober living.
So many sober livings are a fucking scam. Some great ones, but oh my God.
You have to know through support groups, word of mouth.
And one of, I think the best, it's not a sober living, but it's a rehab center, is a place called Cry Help here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And it's spelled C-R-I-H-E-L-P. And it's a nonprofit. And we'll talk in a little bit about the for-profit pitfalls of...
you mean patient brokering? Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Don't get me started.
But Cry Help is really the only one that pops to mind where I know for a fact that they truly have the patient's best interest. And for a lot of people that go there, they're like, they're dicks. Well, they need to be dicks.
Old school.
Yeah, old school. They don't take shit. And they, no matter how rich you are, they will kick you out if you break the rules. And that's what an untreated addict or alcoholic needs.
Yes.
They need
they don't play.
Consequences.
They don't play.
Yeah. And
yeah.
So
talk, I interviewed there.
So talk about the for-profit ones and the pitfalls there, especially as a KDAC.
I've had a little bit of a dance in private, but I didn't know what patient brokering was doing at the time.
And talk about what patient brokering is.
So patient brokering is where, since Obamacare, it's been a gold mine, the treatment industry, because now all of a sudden you can bill your insurance for substance use treatment, which is fabulous. However, it started to be a situation where you had these 22-year-old kids, in my opinion, young, opiate addicts. By the time they're 23, they've gone to 15 treatment centers.
Because, and not cheap treatment centers.
Because they're getting a kickback. So what they would do is they would say, okay, go into treatment, go to detox. After about 28 days, I'm going to need you to use again. I'm going to pay you to go to another center. Sometimes they would put drugs in the bathroom and they would fall out of the mirror. All kinds of tricks so they can keep billing. And so they're brokering these kids. And a lot, most of them are coming from other states. They don't have family here. The parents don't know. And then they die. And the parents don't know what happened. They thought their child was going to treatment. They were also putting implants in for opiate withdrawal, which some of them were not even opiate addicts. That was another thing they could bill the insurance for. The drug tests were a gold mine. It was this whole thing. It's getting better. But it took so long for regulations to come into place. You know, there's so much stigma in the treatment world. It's not like other illnesses where it would have been a red flag and dealt with. There's so much stigma. There's so much secrecy. And so that was going on. So that's how I ended up back in nonprofit.
Talk about your challenge as a drug counselor. What, to the listener who is not familiar with addiction, at least in a way that is kind of deep and nuanced, talk about how you approach it, what works, what doesn't, what are the patterns that you see.
You really have to.
And I also want this, if you can, to talk to people who are the loved ones of an addict, whether they're the parents or the spouse or the boyfriend or girlfriend.
Dr. Drew has told me before, the friends and family are as sick as the person with the chemical dependency. If they don't get their own help, they're contributing to the addict's disease. That makes no sense, because as a family member, you want to help, but you can't. By you helping, you're harming.
When you're talking about helping in terms of enabling, trying to control what they're...
Yes. Yes, the controlling...
The illusion that if you just do this, they will stop.
Yes, thinking that you have some type of contribution, which you can be supportive, but you have to practice detachment.
Talk about that.
Detachment is tricky because you don't want to abandon the person, but you need to stay on your side of the street. You have no idea how and when they're going to recover or what their bottom's going to be or if they're even going to have a bottom. You can't get sick in the process.
And what do you mean? Hold that thought. What do you mean when you say you can't get sick?
Meaning so stressed out with worry and anxiety. What are they doing? There's a part in one of the support groups that says all your attention is focused on what the alcoholic is doing and not doing and how to get them to stop drinking. So it's consumed you. Now you can't work, can't go to school, you can't pay your bills.
So in essence, the same ripples as the person who's drinking or shooting up.
But it's degrading their life. On the outside.
That's right. And you tell yourself, I'm helping.
Yeah.
And so often the solution is the exact opposite of what you think it is.
Contrary action.
It's to not answer the door when, you know, they've broken their promise.
The boundaries. If I could say two words about codependency for someone who's never even heard that term, or what boundaries and detachment. You know, you don't abandon them. There was a big swing toward that for a while, this harshness. I don't like that. I don't do that.
Well, talk about, because obviously there's a gray area in there somewhere between boundaries and, you know, abandonment.
It's a situation by situation process. There's no answer. It's one day at a time, just like in the support groups for alcoholic and addiction recovery. You literally need a sponsor or somebody from a support group to run things by.
You just took the words out of my mouth, because I was going to say one of the things that we do, whether we are the addict or alcoholic or the loved one, is we invest so much of our emotion in an outcome that we can't clearly see what the right thing is to do very often.
No, you're in it.
You're
just as in it as the bottle and the chemicals. It's just, you're in it. You're getting loaded on adrenaline. You're getting loaded on the crisis and being the hero.
Indignation.
Oh, yeah. The Al-Anon salute.
She's putting the back of her hand to her forehead, the martyr.
The Al-Anon handshake?
Pointing the finger.
Yeah.
I think my favorite joke about Al-Anons is, what's the last thing to go through an Al-Anon's mind before they die?
The other person.
Another person's life.
Yeah. It's dripping codependency. Yeah. That's what it is. And I find that harder to deal with than the addict.
Talk about some of the signs that somebody might be codependent.
When I'm talking to someone, what are they saying to me? Is the entire conversation based on what he's doing, she's doing, and she this and she that? It's like, well, what do you do? And I want her to do this and I want her to do that. And she wants, what do you want to do? Like, bring the focus back to yourself. They don't even know they're doing it. Bring the focus back to yourself.
And is it common that they are out of touch with what they're actually feeling?
Absolutely.
Talk.
There's nothing better than focusing on someone else's problems so you don't have to look at your own.
Right.
Especially some charming, exciting, interesting alcoholic who's got a daily episode for you to tend to. You don't have to think about what's going on with you. You're always thinking about what's going on with them. It's a nice place to hide.
Yeah, because on the surface you can go, well, I'm feeling anger and, you know, abandonment and betrayal. But underneath that is a set of feelings that you're running from, which is loneliness, sadness,
right,
grief, self-loathing. What are some of the most common ones that you see when people drill down and get to the emotions that are...
Well, most people who are dripping codependents have grown up taking care of a family member. Their mom or dad was an alcoholic, brother, somebody. This is what they've learned. And then law of attraction, they run into someone. Like, oh, I know how to do this. I know what to do with this. So sometimes they haven't dealt with what happened as a child. And they're just doing the same things they were doing as a kid. They haven't looked at themselves. They haven't even had a moment. They're so distracted. It's a good distraction. So it's the typical unresolved grief, abandonment, loneliness, loss. Because depending on who the alcoholic is, they had half a parent maybe. Maybe the alcoholic was great, sober, Jekyll and Hyde. Different scenarios, but most of the time they just really don't know themselves very well. They haven't taken any time to get to know themselves because they're always distracted by being enmeshed with someone else.
Mm-hmm. Asking them, who do I need to be in this situation for everybody to be happy, for there to not be yelling, for somebody to not be mad at me,
and right,
never even knowing what's my favorite color. What's on my bucket list? What's a place that I'd like to go?
Yeah, I'm okay if you're okay.
Yeah.
That's one face of the codependent. The other one is self-righteous, smug, and dominating. And they know exactly what they want, and they're going to tell you how to do it. And they're just in charge, but not really, because you can't be in charge of that disease. The disease takes you. You have to turn it over. You have to surrender. You have to sit back. Those are the things you don't want to do when you're seeing a loved one hurt. Very difficult to detach and let go. Very difficult. But I've seen a lot of scenarios where a person does detach and does let go, and the person comes back better. I've seen that in my own life with people I've been in love with that were alcoholics. Put up that boundary.
Give me some specific examples if you can.
Well, the person that I was in love with kept relapsing. So I set a boundary. Okay, from now on, when we meet, we're going to go on a date and you're going to pay and you're going to show up. And that's it. Now, I thought this guy is never going to be able to get it together to do this because he could only get about 30 days, if 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I held that boundary and he showed up. But I had to let go of the fear that I might lose him. Oh, he'll go out with someone else. It'll take care of him like I used to. The fear of loss, all that stuff. I had to put these boundaries and then I had to trust that the person was going to be okay. I mean, one time, this one was hard. The boundary was, if you're at my house, you cannot drink. So we had an honesty, which was a bit strange, but he called and said, okay, I drank. I said, well, then you can't come home with me. So he slept outside that night. I was terrified. I slept over to the support group around the corner. And I don't like to share my stuff because clinician, physician heals
herself. She's rolling her eyes in herself.
So I told the story and all these people came up and they said, oh yeah, I went through that. That's happened to me. I've done that before. And he made it through the night. He was fine.
I'm sure you've heard the joke. What's the difference between a dog and an alcoholic? When you let a dog back in, it stops whining.
I never heard that before. Yeah. So, I mean, it's scary. And I mean, you really need the main thing I could stress is you cannot do it by yourself. You need support. And you have to go to safe places to talk about it with people that understand and a structure. Because the average person will be afraid or judgmental, but mostly afraid. You know, I did some pretty dangerous things to help clients and addicts in my past.
Talk about those.
Well, I mean, I would go into a drug house and I would take people out and take them to detox in my car, not knowing if they were going to have a seizure. I mean, I did these wild things. I don't do this stuff anymore. But for me, I was diving into the inferno. You know, I wasn't really able to help my mom with drinking. So now I'm an adult and I'm a clinician and I've got books and medicine. I'm going to play with all these tools. Of course, I'm doing all the don'ts for my support group. You know, don't keep checking up on the alcoholic. Don't wallow in self-pity. Don't interfere with a crisis if it's in the natural course of events. Well, now you've just taken my job away.
Who am I without them?
I'm a crisis counselor. I get paid to do the don'ts. It was two hats. I had to wear two hats. It was tricky. It was very tricky.
Give me an example of the don't interfere if it's a what did you call it, a crisis?
Don't interfere in a crisis if it's in the natural course of events.
And what does that mean?
So if someone is insisting that they're going to take the car, go drink, go use, and don't interfere, like don't run up and attack them to get the keys away from them. There's so many situations where if it's in the natural course of events, you know, don't drive across town and pound on the door and drag them out of the room because you think they might be dying from drinking. If it's in the natural, it's a hard thing to do.
Right.
It's a very hard, and they're going to call and ask for help. Luckily, the person I was involved with didn't really call and ask for help too much. He tried to do it on his own a lot more.
What would an unnatural course of events be? That they're having a heart attack or they're overdosing and you need to, you know, call 911?
Yes. Or, you know, if, it, again, very case-by-case situation, but if someone were to call and say, I want to go to treatment. Can you give me a ride? Okay. But I'm not stopping anymore. I mean, you got to set it up.
I'm not getting cigarettes for you.
I had my guy say to me one time, so, because I was going to meet him somewhere thinking he was sober. When I got there, he was not sober. I said, well, then I got to go. Natural course of events. He's like, well, you're going to go in that store and you're going to get me some cigarettes. And I said, who do you think you're talking to? I'm not doing that. And if you're going to keep drinking tonight, then I'm going to go home. But I don't want you to go home. Well, that's the boundary. Then you just have to stop talking.
And is that why you required him to pay on dates? So
later,
that he wasn't just mooching off you for
yes.
food?
Yes. So it was more of a balanced exchange.
Gotcha.
And, I mean, he had had some dripping codependence in his past, and unfortunately that's how he survived. And then he met me and was like, oh, this is a whole different situation. We did a lot of meetings together. We did recovery together.
What are some of the most cunning behaviors of the untreated alcoholic addict or even the treated alcoholic addict that the codependence falls for?
When they're crying and saying, I really want help and I'm not doing this again.
What do you do?
Dr. Drew has a fun little scene on a video where he talks about this kid that was just crying and saying, I'm done. I overdosed this time. And Dr. Drew said, you know, you're so full of shit. I don't even know what the truth is. And then he goes, oops, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But it just came out of him naturally. And the kid goes, I know. You got to call them. You got to tell them the truth. That's what they do in the support groups.
So when you say detach, meaning, you know, if they want to go to rehab, and you said they need a ride, you give them a ride, but you won't stop anywhere in between them. Let's say they're like, I want to get clean now. I need a place to stay for 2 nights.
What? It depends on their history, how many times they've been to treatment, your experiences with them. But I've always been very clear with the boundaries. Okay, but this is the situation. You can't drink here. You can't leave at night. You know, you're very, very, in my experience, don't be afraid to communicate your needs to someone going through that. They know what they're doing, and they know it's, they just want someone they can actually tell the truth to. I've found that many times. I'll just walk right up, say, how many days do you have? So what'd you do? Just ask the questions. They want to talk about it. They're sick of their own lies. They like it when you call them out. The ones that, if you're working in a world where people are healing, support groups, things like that, most of the ones you're going to run into, they want to be called out.
It's one of the reasons I could go to my meetings, is keeps me right-sized, gives me a chance to think about other people in a healthy way.
Right. You say what you mean, don't say it mean.
I like that. I've never heard that before.
Lois, you say what you mean. You know, don't attack them. Don't punish them. Don't condescend them. You say, very compassionate, but firm with the boundary.
Right.
This is what it is. What do you want to do?
It's so tempting to want to, quote, enlighten them, unquote. And boy, is that its own pitfall of grandiosity and disillusionment.
I used to play the Big Book on YouTube while my guy was detoxing. I thought that was going to work. He's laying there like, this is the last thing I want to hear right now. I thought that was working.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, Big Book is support group literature.
Yes, for alcoholics in recovery.
So how are you today? One of the things that you shared in your email, your son has grown, he moved out, and...
Empty nester with 4 cats.
Is there a plan for a fifth? Are things that bad?
I said to my son, okay, so this is the consolation prize? I'm okay. I mean, it's the fallout from the pandemic. I don't think people realize how much it's affected people's mental health.
How did it affect yours?
I had kind of a different experience because my job actually got busier and prospered because all the people that couldn't go to jail from the pandemic were sent to my agency. So...
Oh, because they weren't bringing new people into jails?
They could... Oh. Yeah, they couldn't let, they couldn't
at least bring, low-level offenders?
Yes, nonviolent offenders were let out on their own recognizance. And then, so they were coming to us for treatment to resolve their case.
Gotcha.
So we got very busy, and we were doing it all on Zoom. We locked our doors in March 2020 like everyone else. Like, how are we going to get people clean? We can't drug test them. We can't see them. You'd be surprised how many people got clean on Zoom.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few.
I couldn't believe
it. It's amazing to me.
I was shocked because I was trained old school. Yeah, just going to Zoom meetings. So on that level, financially, it was fine. But now it's the fallout with people's mental health. For me, I did lose a lot of people during that time. My father passed away, one of my best friends. 28 years sober, died right in the pandemic. I had another friend about the same amount of time sober, committed suicide.
Oh my God.
And then my guy right before the pandemic. So in 19 and 20, I lost 4 people very close together. So I kind of threw myself into work.
And do you, now that work has, I assume it's slowed down from
yes.
then. What, if any, are the feelings you're processing or looking at or still running from?
Well,
Obviously sadness.
Yes, but around this time I found comedy. And that became my cure. My father was always yelling at me, "Humor's the cure. Humor." I was like, "What are you talking about, Dad?" My dad had depression. Now I know what he means. So around the time I discovered podcasts and I discovered stand-up comics, and then I understood what my dad was talking about. So I found some way to lighten up because I like to go dark. I can sit there and I'll go dark with you and we'll get to the bottom of it, but I have to have some fun, you know, and I love how comedians talk about mental health. I love it because they're talking about it, they're acknowledging it, they're teaching people about it, and then they're bringing light to it. So that was sort of my saving grace through all the grief. That really helped me. Maron's podcast really helped me because of his public loss and how he talked about it. Mm-hmm. That was around the same time as mine. So, and then I have my own support groups. So, I don't know. I like to run away from it. I like to help other people and be distracted.
What are your unhealthiest coping mechanisms?
Well, it's going to sound kind of silly, but I like to binge watch shows.
You're a monster.
And I like to do these Mandela designs. And it doesn't sound bad, but when you're doing those for hours, you're not talking to your friends. That's my main coping. I isolate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my most unhealthy is isolating.
What do you think in isolating, what do you think you're avoiding feeling or thinking?
Grief, loss.
And how does isolating keep you from thinking or feeling about that, because you're in your compulsive behavior, whatever it is?
Because I have trouble telling people that I'm in pain. I like to put on a good face, act as if. So if you're asking me to go out for coffee, I'm not going to emotionally throw up on you. Like, I kind of shut down and just go into my own inner world to feel better. I have a lot of trouble asking for help.
Are you in pain right now?
I'm on an upswing this week. I'm okay. 3 weeks ago, it was a different world.
Describe what that was like.
Sleeping 10 hours a day, can't make it to work on time. Not picking up the phone when my friends call. It just garden variety depression. In all its faces and camouflages. It's so easy to say, oh, it's stress at work. Oh, it's the deaths. It's like, no, I've been like this my entire life. Give me everything that a perfect person would want. I'm telling you, the chemicals in my brain will take a dip and I'll still feel like shit. No one gets that. It's all situational to people.
I think the people who listen to this podcast get it. I think they're like, yay, one of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing you say one time that you were joking about someone's depression and you said, but they're so good looking. And I completely got that joke.
Yeah, you know, some people don't.
People say self-fulfilled prophecy. No.
Pray harder.
The bypass.
Yeah.
That one gets me.
Well, Kaylee, I'm really glad we connected. Shout out to Scott Bloom for putting us in contact.
Bloom Productions.
With each other. Yeah, you're a great advocate, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Many, many thanks to her and the work that she does and all the people out there in the trenches. We are going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
This is... Oh, I almost forgot to mention this. As you guys know, we occasionally have advertisers on the podcast, and we go through periods where there aren't many. And I'm talking about the ads where we, where I'm reading the copy, not the ones where it's injected. The ones where it's injected and it's and it somebody else is, you know, a la a radio commercial. Those don't bring in much money at all. The ones that do bring in a little bit more money are the ones where I'm reading the ad. But those are getting harder and harder to come by as more and more podcasts kind of take up the podcast landscape. And so one of the things that would help me get more advertisers would be if you would fill out a completely anonymous survey. And I'll put the link to this in the show notes for this episode. And the link is gum.fm/mental. And that would greatly help. It's totally anonymous. They don't gather any data on you. And it's just wanting to know, you know, how much money does your household make? You know, what are your spending habits? What do you think about this part of the podcast, that part of the podcast? Et cetera, et cetera. But it helps to pair the podcast with sponsors. So that would be a great way to help out if you feel like it. And if you don't, go fuck yourself. This is from the Shouldn't Feel This Way survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself The Anomaly. He is in his 30s and describes himself as asexual. How would you like people to think of you? I want people to see me as unapproachable. I want them to be intimidated by me, uneasy around me, and know that I'm infinitely smarter than they are. I want them to keep their distance and think of me not as a person they can get close to or invite to things, but as a force to be reckoned with at work, who they shouldn't be around too long. That is so interesting because I've never heard somebody, and I suppose this is why you're calling yourself the anomaly, but I've never heard somebody... Excuse me, I'm trying to scooch my chair up, and I'm struggling. Should I start a GoFundMe for a chair scooching? How does it feel writing that? I'm so tired, I just want to be left alone. I don't want to be hurt again. I'm not going to survive another betrayal. How would you use a time machine? I'd go back in time and either kill my younger self, one of my parents, both of them, or all three of us. I'm supposed to feel happy about what I've done with my life, but I don't. I feel angry that I had to fight and claw and fuck my way to a stable position in my life while so many people around me just had everything handed to them on a plate. I'm supposed to feel proud of my accomplishments. I'm the youngest department head ever appointed at my university, but I don't. I feel like it's not enough. I don't want to just be admired. I want to be on a pedestal too high for anyone to reach me, so they won't try to get close to me. I'm supposed to feel closure about my abusers since they're dead, but I don't. I feel cheated that I don't get to hurt them as badly as they hurt me. I don't want them to be dead because then I can't find a way to make their lives the living hell they deserve for it to be. How does it feel making your real feelings, writing your real feelings out? I can practically hear the last three therapists I went to in my head telling me, no, you don't want to be left alone. You want to have friends. Everyone does. And hey, you need to forgive your abusers. They're your parents. And my least favorite, the thing that made me quit therapy, surely you had good times with your abusers. Everyone does. And on some level, you love them. It feels as if what I say I feel doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is how other people think I feel. None of my actual emotions matter. They didn't matter when I was six and my parents were both sexually assaulting me at the same time. They don't now, a full 30 years later. people that say that you need to forgive somebody, I say this all the time on the podcast, but they can go fuck themselves post haste. I don't even know what post haste means. I am not a big believer in you should forgive somebody. If you can forgive somebody, hey, that's awesome. But if you can't, that's where you're at. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's what you feel. And we've had a lot of people fill surveys out where there were no positive experiences with the people who raised them and abused them. So you are not alone in that one, brother. And I'm sorry that you've had shitty experiences with therapy. There are good therapists out there, though, but there's also a lot of shitty ones. Do you think you're abnormal for feeling what you do? I'm deeply abnormal. Everyone has good memories of their abusers. Everyone wants to be around people. Everyone is doing something different than what I'm doing in response to what I've been through. Sometimes I don't think of myself as a person, just a strange entity that exists separate from humans. When I watched the movie Across the Spider-Verse and heard someone referred to as the anomaly, I felt a sense of overwhelming connection. I'm the anomaly. I'm not doing this right. And by this, I mean trauma, life, and being human. Would knowing other people feel the same way make you feel better about yourself? Probably. Oh, brother, sending you some love, man. And I can tell you, when I was processing the trauma that I went through with my mom's shit, I felt so clumsy, awkward, just like you're doing this completely wrong. And it just took the shame, because I was no longer blaming myself for what had happened to me as a child. I was now blaming myself for the way I was processing what was happening to me as a survivor. And so, just sending you some love, man. This is from the sexual abuse of a young male by an older female survey. I always wish there was a different name for that, but I... Should we call it Stacy's Mom Survey? This is filled out by Nasrin. She identifies as straight. She's in her 30s. Says that she was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. She was a victim of sexual abuse outside of the events here. And although she wasn't a victim in events here, she never reported what had happened to her in the events outside the survey. And she writes, I'm 39 and in a relationship with a 20-year-old. I met him at a support group for survivors of childhood sexual abuse when he was 16, and we became friends pretty quickly, but it took about 3 years before we started dating. He was interested in me early on. I just wasn't sure if it was ethical to be with him. I was also really reluctant to be with him since he was abused by an older woman when he was younger. It's still very difficult for us to be sexual with each other because I'm always worried about coercing him into something. I'd hoped going to college would make him give up interest in me and fall for someone his own age. Instead, he fell in love, got his heart broken by a girl who told him he was trauma dumping on her and making her be his therapist. When he told her about how he was abused as a child and ended up crying on my shoulder because he felt unlovable. I've felt unlovable my entire life since what happened. He fell asleep, cuddled up with me on the couch. I went to the eye doctor today and they put those dilation drops in. So I always struggle a little bit with the reading, but I'm really struggling with it tonight. I felt unlovable my entire life since what happened. He fell asleep, cuddled up with me on the couch. When we woke up in the morning, he kissed me and told me that no matter what, even if we never dated, he would always love me because I didn't think he was too broken to be around. I kissed him back. We spent a long time just making out and talking. A week later, when he had spring break, he surprised me with a week away in a touristy little town at a bed and breakfast. There we ended up having sex. I have never had sex like this before, where I felt like a person and not just a fuckhole. I've never had consensual sex before at all. Wow. We spent a lot of time talking and working through my shit and his shit, and now we're dating. I know people will probably think it's predatory or sick. I'm afraid maybe it is, but I love him more than I've ever loved anyone in my life. If something happened, did you ever tell anyone? Did you think it was normal? Do you believe it has had any effect on you? I know it's not normal. I know people probably think I'm a predator. I love him, and he's made me reevaluate how I think about myself, others, trauma, and hope. He's had great effects on my life, but if anyone knew outside of my family and his, they would hate me. Remembering these things, what feelings come up? I love him. I would die for him. I will do anything and everything to make his life better, and he does everything he can to make my life better too. The phenomenal sex isn't the most important part of it. It's the fact that I feel like a person when I'm with him. I think it's innocent and natural, our sex. I worry that I might have done damage to him by falling in love with him. It keeps me up at night. One of the reasons I wanted to read this, one, I find it interesting and compelling, and it has stuff that's in that gray area, which I find to be the most interesting to talk about and to think about. And I don't think of you as a predator. You know, the thing, my thought as I was reading this, and I could be completely off base, but my thought as I was reading this is that these are two people who have a lot of wounds who are trying to use the other person to fill a part of themselves that was left empty by their wounds. And I don't know if that makes sense or not, or if it's even accurate, but that's just the vibe I get from reading this. So the thing that I... That is a red flag to me, just in terms of is this relationship ideal? Is it sustainable? Is that there is that trauma bonding, and trauma bonding is fucking amazing in the beginning, and then you stop feeling filled up by that person, and then you become frustrated with that person because they can't keep rescuing you. And you know, the sentences like, I would die for him. I would do anything and everything to make his life better. And he does everything he can to make my life better too. It sounds enmeshed and, like there's no where do you end and where does he begin? And that to me is as much, if not more, of a red flag than the age difference. And, you know, it sounds like he was of legal age when the two of you got together. So I don't know, but I love how beautifully complicated that is. And I wish you both the best. And I mean that sincerely from the bottom of my heart. I don't know who I'm talking like, but it's got to be somebody from a movie in the 50s. And you know the movie ended with that person saying, I love that gal. I love her. She's going to be the mother of my kids. You just look, hey, what? What's the big idea? You know, somewhere in history, somebody, right before they got stabbed and died, said, hey, what's the big idea? This is from the love survey filled out by Chrissy. Chrissy writes, I love putting away the grocery cart and slamming it perfectly back into the other. That is an awesome one. You know, one of my loves, reading a love that I've never read before. We've been doing these for years, and they can get a little, I don't know if I would say repetitive, because there's always a little variation, especially with the animals ones. But that, oh, that's a, we got to have a word for one that breaks, breaks the mold. Mold breaker. There we go. I just answered my own question. Look at this. I don't need you. I can do this podcast by myself. I love a sunny Sunday at home on the couch, not having any more chores left to do. I love the way my mom's dog looks into my eyes with love while I pet her on her tummy. Speaking of that, I just posted a video to Patreon of Gracie, and she does this every, and I've meant to record this 100 times, but whenever we wake up from a nap, I go into the bathroom, brush my teeth, straighten my hair, put in the curlers, steam it, dye it, get rid of the perm, do the perm again, call a friend, ask him if I should have gotten rid of the perm or if I should have kept it. No, but I come out of the bathroom, and she is always not only laying on her back, but she is positioned so that she is looking at me upside down, like eyes contacting me before I even walk through the door, like, like just waiting to lure me in with her loving gaze. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey, and this is filled out by Hank, and in parentheses, same Hank as from the other surveys with the incestuous mom and anxiety issues. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? You're a bad person if you think of what your mom did as abuse. She loved you. She supported you. She was the only person there for you when no one else was. And when your dad thought you were too wicked and evil to be saved, she taught you no one is beyond Allah's love. You're a bad person if you think what she did doesn't count as abuse. You're excusing and enabling incest and pedophilia, and you're a monster. You're bad if you don't know how to feel. You're old enough. You should have known what you feel and think, and you're insane and pathetic for not knowing. You're too messed up for a relationship. You're not messed up enough to deserve therapy when people have had much worse things happen. And let's be real, women who are victims of incest deserve therapy more than you. You're a man. Men are supposed to be stronger than this, and you weren't assaulted and penetrated like girls are. You were given handjobs and cuddles by someone you willingly got into bed with. How fucking dare you compare your pain to theirs? How self-centered, self-important, and egotistical you are. The only reason Allah loves you is because he has to, because that's how mercy works, not because you deserve to be loved. Wow. Wow. Thank you for sharing that, Hank. That is, I think anybody who has ever experienced a sexual violation recognizes that that is what the human brain does so often with trauma, is it just finds a way to punish you and gaslight you and keep you guessing and unsure and filled with doubt and self-recrimination and self-hatred. And I'm so sorry you're experiencing that, Hank. Sending you some love, man. Oh, I just dimmed the lights, and maybe I'm expecting somebody to... I can't think of something that could be delivered that's romantic. I don't know. I was going to say like a singing telegram. When was the last time somebody received a singing telegram? 900 years ago? This is from the Love Survey filled out by Brett Bobbs. And they write, I love catching yourself in the moment, either being present with where you are and how your life is, or waking up early, catching the sunrise from outside your window. Finally, being able to set boundaries with my family. My mom is codependent and my dad is an alcoholic. Being proud of being sober from alcohol for 6 years and having no desire to go back, even at my lowest points. Kudos to you. Volunteering at the shelter and seeing a new cat in the room I take care of, I get to greet them and find out their personality. Also knowing that a cat is getting adopted from my room makes me so happy, and I get to say goodbye before they go into their forever homes. The first cold day of the year, when you need to go back inside to get a jacket after sweating for 6 months. Moving halfway across the country to get away from my parents. And finally finding friends I can call my family after 6 years of being depressed. And this one, I have to assume they're talking about Halloween. When it's finally spooky season and you are surrounded by death and blood and ghosts, but with a happy mood behind it instead of the horrors of reality. Thank you for those. This is from the first day in therapy survey, and this is filled out. I did not create this survey. This was created a long time ago by a listener who was putting herself through getting her license to be a therapist. And for one of her projects, she said, "Can I use your podcast to ask people about their therapy experiences?" And so people are still taking it. How many people have taken this one? This is number 1,400. 1,400 people have taken this survey. And this is filled out by... they don't ask for the names or genders with this one. But this person's between 18 and 25. What brought you to therapy? Childhood trauma. Describe any fears you had associated with starting therapy. I was scared to meet a new person and confide in them. I was scared that I wouldn't be understood and that they wouldn't be able to help me. Did any of your fears come true? Both of them kind of came true. My first therapist just let me talk, and that was it. I didn't feel understood or seen. She didn't give me any tools to work with. She just let me talk and figure it out on my own. My third therapist was amazing. I've been with her for a little over 3 years. We slowly built a safe space together. For me, body-focused work was amazing in combination with schema therapy. Is it schema or schema? I think it's schema. I know it's not scummy. Because I got to tell you, if there was an unpopular therapy, scummy therapy is at the top of the list. Figuring out what my body was telling me has been a wonderful tool, and just being able to vent and leave my shit somewhere. She has a very holistic approach. It doesn't feel clinical. For me, that feels amazing. There's a nice balance of me figuring things out myself and her guiding me. I love how she makes me feel seen and how she makes me feel like a person who knows a lot about themselves. I've been made to feel like a very sick person at times, a person who will never get better and will always feel bad, who will always stay in need of therapy. My therapist saw my strengths and built upon them with me. I was never made to feel small and inferior, just two people connecting and learning from each other. Do you feel you can be completely honest with your therapist? If yes, describe how you came to feel that way. If not, describe why that is, what changes you could make, or some things you think your therapist could do to make you feel, help you feel safer. I was very depressed, anxious, and destructive. My current therapist was a stable and safe-ish place to go to every week. I never felt safe. Slowly, over time, she showed me that I could trust her, that she listened to me, and that I could tell her whatever. We found a way to connect with each other even when I was very dissociated. Slowly over the years, I was able to relax more and more. Slowly, I stopped needing to survive. She was there for all of the lows, steady and honest. She made me feel like she trusted me too, which made me open up even more. If something she did was uncomfortable or once or twice even scary for me, we were able to talk about it and she would make sure that it never happened again. Her steady, safe space gave me the freedom to slowly ground myself and love myself more and more. I love it. I love it. And, you know, they say that a good therapeutic relationship can be kind of a template for our relationships outside of therapy. And I have found that to be very much true. You know, for many of us, it can be the first place where we get up the balls to say, I don't like the way you said that to me, or I don't like that you use these words, or, you know, even if we're making it up in our mind, just addressing that gives us the experience of working through something without either running or exploding. This is from the babysitter survey, and then you see the theme here. This is filled out by Remy, and this is so dark. I should have saved this one for. Well, I'm just going to read it. My babysitter drugged me and had her boyfriend rape me while she watched and masturbated. I was 8. My parents didn't believe me. I was convinced it happened because I was a bad person and deserved it. I still do sometimes. I don't think I'm worthy of love, and I don't feel safe being with anyone. So I try to avoid romance and relationships entirely. Remembering these things, what feelings come up? Fear, overwhelming anxiety, the desire to rip my own hair out, and the relief that I've isolated myself so much it can never happen again. Do you feel any damage was done? It destroyed my capacity to trust, and I don't think of love as a real possibility for myself. Have you been the victim of any sexual abuse outside of the events described here? Oh, man. I blew a teacher in high school to get my math grade up to passing. I don't even know what to say. I don't even know what to say. That's so horrifying. I'm so sorry that all of those things, that those things happened to you. And on top of it, your parents not believing you. I mean, that, fuck, dude. I feel like there's something I should be saying, and I don't know what it is. Because I feel like it feels incomplete, and I don't know what it is that I want to say other than, I'm sending you some love, brother. And then finally, this is from the Loves survey. And this is filled out by Spiral. And Spiral writes, I love situations where I can see the wind, clouds scudding along and in the sky, or where sunlight gets reflected off of water's wavelets, the long grass on a hillside bending and dancing in the afternoon, and fallen snow getting stirred up by the wind. I love that parts of nature conspire to show me what I cannot see, but can feel. What I know is there. It gives me faith that there are other ways of encountering, of knowing the world around me. That's beautiful. Very well said. Very poetic. I wonder if you wrote it with one of those big fancy fountain pens. God, that last survey just, I don't know why that it's the feeling of reading that is just sitting. Are you guys feeling that? I mean, a lot. Maybe it was just that there was kind of a theme through the heavy surveys of this podcast, or maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just, I don't know. Just if you're out there and you relate to any of the surveys, maybe it's because there was just so much heaviness and pain in so many of the surveys tonight. If you're out there and you're anybody who heard their survey read or relates to the surveys that were read, just hang in there. Fuck. I don't know what to say.
I'll tell you what to say. Gadzooks, look at that game. Those gams ain't gams.
I don't even know what that means. And now my voice hurts. If you're out there and you're feeling stuck, never forget, you are not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up in some weird way.